Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, please give a warm welcome to Ajahn Brahm. But before we begin, let me continue with a few more announcements. For Vesak Day, on Vesak Eve actually, we have a few activities lined up right here at BGF. On the 4th of May, which is the Friday, we have offering of candle lights and milk fries. It begins at 7:45, and Vesak Eve Puja will begin at 8 o'clock, followed by Creating Heaven on Earth, which is a sharing session by Brother Benny Liao. And then we have Vesak Hymns by iGEMS and the Metta Meditations. And on Vesak Day, we begin at 8:30 a.m. With the offering of candlelight, the bathing of the baby Buddha, offering of flowers, offering of milk rice. And at 9 o'clock, we'll have Metta around the world. And at 9:30, the Vesak Day Puja will start, followed by a speech by the BGF President, Dr. Victor Wee. And then we have the Vesak performance, the 5 precepts by the GEM kids. And there'll be the speeches by the 26th Effective Speaking Course 2012. And after that, we have a Dhamma sharing session called Now by Venerable Lama Karma Samten. And then the blessings. And 11:30 a.m., we have lunch offerings and lunch for devotees. And on Vesak Sunday, which is the 6th of May, Puja starts at 10 o'clock. And at 10:30, there will be a GEM Kids Dhamma class and the Fundamentals of Buddhism Lesson 4, Life in Other Worlds, and lunch for devotees as well. Just a few more to go. Alright, and if you like what we're doing here at BGF, do show some support. You can come for the musical concert. It's called All for Love Charity Concert by Yuli and Zheng Shuqin for BGF fundraising on the 25th of May 2012 at the HGH Convention Center. And you can get the tickets from Brother Mong Sing or Sister Doris. Tickets starts at 100, 150, 200, 250. And I'll take that to send commission. Last but not least, we have a lot of activities at BGF. You can look them up on the board on your right. It's right there. See all the posters there. Yeah, you will find some origami classes, Ikebana, Sutra class, Vesak programs, and Dhamma talks. Alright, I'll stop right here. And let me. For formality's sake, yeah. Let me introduce Ajahn Brahm. Okay. Ajahn Brahma Vanso Mahathera, or more lovingly known as Ajahn Brahm. He was born Peter Betts in London on a fateful day of August 7, 1951. And he came from a working class background, and he won a scholarship to study theoretical physics at Cambridge. And after graduating from Cambridge, he taught in high school for a year before traveling to Thailand to become a monk and train with the Venerable Ajahn Chah Bodhiyana Mahathera. And currently, Ajahn Brahm is the abbot of Bodhiyana Monastery in Serpentine, Western Australia, the spiritual director of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, spiritual advisor to the Buddhist Society of South Australia, and spiritual patron of the Buddhist Fellowship in Singapore, and is currently working with monks and nuns of all Buddhist traditions to establish the Australian Sangha Association. So without further ado, let us pass the mic to Ajahn Brahm.
So I'm also a great friend of the Buddhist GEM Fellowship. And when I got the word that you wanted some help with the fundraising of your new center. I thought, yes, I'm going to come. And now it's my turn to serve and to give and to help and to sort of try and encourage more people actually to practice this beautiful Buddhism in a non-sectarian, non-superstitious, beautiful way. And that's why I've come here today. I have not got any money to give you, Victor. But what happened to me once, I remember going, the first time I went to Singapore, they took me to visit all the major Buddhist temples. And when they took me to visit, I think it's called the Mangala Vihara, that is the Sri Lankan temple in Singapore, having taken me around the temple, the abbot asked me to sign the visitor's book. Which is what you usually do. And unfortunately, I've already written my name and the address. And it was then when I looked at the next column, how much you're going to give. Because I realised I'd picked up the wrong book. This was not the visitor's book, this was a donation book. And I'd already filled in my name and address. So I was in a really big spot of trouble. Because if you just put nothing, what is that? People read that book and think that Ajahn Brahm is just so stingy, he won't get anything. So thinking very quickly, I wrote my donation to the Mangala Vihara, my life. And I wrote that and I thought, what a wonderful thing, because that's also my donation to the Buddhist Gem Fellowship, Victor, my life. And that's a wonderful thing to be able to do, because that gives you so much happiness. And for a lot of my life, this giving to others, caring, serving, looking after others has been one of the great sources of not just joy, but good health. I just realized the last time I went to see the doctor was about 20 years ago now. So I've been very, very healthy monk. And look, all these times I keep traveling all over the world, I never once cancel because of sickness. And the reason is, I just don't get sick. Why? And why is it that also this idea of kindness and generosity, it also really gives you very, very powerful meditations. In fact, you could put generosity and giving, if you really understand what it truly is, at the very heart of the Buddhist path to enlightenment, to liberation. In fact, it is one of the most beautiful paths. And to understand what I mean, you can just see just the amount of happiness and joy which people get when they do through acts of kindness and generosity. I learned this very early on in my life as a Buddhist. Now remember, I came from working class family in London. And in those days, it was every man for himself or every boy for himself. You weren't generous at all. But then something changed when I started reading about Buddhism and started meditating. You know, it was so wonderful to be able to give. And I remember, this was I was still at Cambridge University as a student. I joined three societies while I was a student. One was the Astronomical Society, so I was always really interested knowing the science of space and what actually lies out there. So I was now as a member of the Astronomical Society. The second society I joined was the Psychic Research Society. I was always interested in ghosts. Ghosts and weird stuff. I really love that. That's why I still got lots and lots of ghost stories which I could tell you. Actually, just you know the way I give talks. I don't think I told you that ghost story here, because when was the last time I was here? Some while ago. This was about last Rains Retreat, last October. Last October, I got a call from a Sri Lankan lady whose brother was so sick with a cancer
for they sent him to Singapore to try and get the very best treat. But even spending huge amounts of money, this man was getting more and more sick and was getting so close to dying that the sister called me over in Perth and begged me, said, I know you're on retreat, but can you please talk to my brother? He's dying, he's only got a couple of days to go. And of course, even though that this is supposed to be the time when I don't do anything, which I just relax and I can't say no, somebody needed some help and they were dying. You couldn't wait till it was convenient to me when you're dying. So I said yes. And so for three nights, I can't remember now, I called him and in his hospital bed in Singapore. And I remember that it took him a long time to speak because he had hardly any energy. I found out later that he was actually paralyzed from the neck down by this time because of the cancer. It's so difficult for him to speak. I think the third night, that's right, the only two nights I talked with him. On the third night, he passed away. He died. Because the fourth night, his sister called me. And he said, the reason why, we didn't call you last night, because he died. Mm-hmm. He said, I have to tell you, not just that he died, something very strange happened this morning. About 12 hours after he died, he sent me an email. True story. Now, he could not have actually put this on the computer and actually put a time to send it because he'd been paralyzed for days. He had no access to the computer. And he sent the email 12 hours after he passed away, just with the word, thank you, for letting Ajahn Brahm speak with you. Now, I told people after I heard that story, as a monk, I always wondered what Gmail means. Now I know it means ghost. But be careful when your mother or father or grandma dies. Be careful sending emails after they die. I was always interested in that stuff, and of course the fourth society which I joined was the Buddhist Society. And I was a really active member of the Buddhist Society of Cambridge from the time I was 18. And I remember that first year, many people would come and give talks, but you know, most of the talks were boring. You know, you've been to those boring talks. The monk or the teacher, they go and talk about dependent origination and Abhidharma, and gee, I couldn't understand it. And I was studying theoretical physics. Even I couldn't understand that. But every now and again, you've got a teacher who taught from the heart. And I remember once there was an English woman who was working, I think, in Nepal or somewhere on the borders between Tibet. She took a sort of Tibetan ordination, was just running an orphanage for children. And she was not saying the theory of Buddhism, she was saying the practice. She was being compassionate and kind and devoting her life to looking after kids who had no parents. And of course, she needed funds. So the following day, I was so inspired, I went to my bank and I drew out 10 British pounds to give as a donation to this orphanage. Now that may not seem much to you. This was in 1969 or 70. Remember, my father had already died. My mother was just scraping by as best she could. And I was at university. That was 2 weeks' food money for me. I never starved because you had the food at the canteen at the college. But I went hungry. I didn't have as much as I normally would, because I gave that £10 to this orphanage. And to this day, even though that hurt, I mean that physically hurt me, because I went hungry, I couldn't eat what I wanted. Nevertheless, that was one of the best donations I ever made. And I remember it to this day, which is now over 40 years later. A constant source of joy and happiness, just to me as a monk. I learned from those experiences that you never waste money when you give a real kind, generous donation. You do forget it and spend it on yourself. You go on summer holiday or buy a dress or buy a new car or whatever you do. If you do it to some place or something which really is important, you remember that for the rest of your life. It's a constant source of joy. But once I learned that, it was just inspiring for me to do it once. Once you get into it, you can hardly stop yourself. You just want to find other places where you can really make a difference. And I remember also, just before I left England to go to Thailand to become a monk, I'd been working for 1 year, as was told already, as a school teacher. I wasn't spending much money, but what I did do, what I had to get just to go from where I was working to the school, was a motorbike. Sometimes you can't imagine me in a motorbike, but I had one. Vroom, vroom, vroom. But I was told that when you become a Buddhist monk, you can't ride motorbikes. You know why?
The road will balloon out. Fly up in the air.
What about me getting under your nose? So I had to get rid of my motorbike. And my mother had a friend who wanted a motorbike. And again, I remember this story as if it was yesterday, even though it was almost 40 years ago. He came around to my mother's apartment. I showed him the bike. It was a lovely bike. I kept it in good repair. I looked after things. And he said he wanted it. And he said, let's go upstairs to settle up. In other words, to agree a price. And then when we went upstairs in front of my mother, he said, how much do you want for it? And I said, do you want it? He said, yes, I want it. How much do you want for it? He said, if you want it, you can have it for free. I don't need any money. I'm going to become a monk. And I remember the look on his face. He looked at me, he was really confused. And he turned to my mother, and my mother says, well, he's not crazy, he's going to become a monk, okay? He's okay. And she later wrote to me and said that friend of hers who took that bike for free, he was so impressed that it was the first time in his life he'd been given something for free. Something important and valuable. It had taught him the beauty of generosity by being on the receiving end. Acts like that make the life, everybody's life, very beautiful. I also recall, these are just stories. I love telling these stories because it makes me happy, it inspires me. Sometimes, you know, we look at life and there's things, somebody just told me I have to lock them. My room up the top there, because we lost the main key to the Buddhist Gem Fellowship, apparently, so now we've got to lock everything. Isn't that sad that we have to lock things up? I'm sad that people have their motorbikes or their goods stolen or people go into their houses. That just really gets down, it depresses us. That's why I love to tell stories of generosity and kindness, and how it actually works. In Perth, there was a front page story some years ago of a boy coming home from school. He had a BMX bike. It's a very high quality, expensive bike. And he got it from his father for his birthday. And on the way home, he passed a couple of other boys, maybe 2 or 3 years older than him, who caught a rabbit. They were torturing that poor little rabbit. And even though these boys were bigger than him, this young school kid stopped his bike and told those bigger boys to stop hurting that poor defenseless little rabbit. And the boys said, no, get out of here, it's none of your business. They wouldn't stop. And remember, they were bigger than him, he was a small guy. So he said, I'll give you my BMX bike if you give me that rabbit. He was willing to give up this very expensive bicycle to help a small defenseless animal so it would not get hurt. And those kids that wanted to buy, yeah, deal. So he took the rabbit and walked home. When his parents asked, "Where's your bike? That cost a lot of money." And when he explained what had happened, the parents were so impressed they got a kick like that. They never scolded him, but they rang up the local newspaper. They came round and took a photograph of that boy and put him on the front page of the newspaper. Now that was an inspiring story. A kick. You know, who would care more for a tortured animal than his own possessions, who would actually give to save the life of a little rabbit. The next day, there's a follow-up story in the newspaper. The follow-up story was, that day, three new BMX bikes appeared at that boy's house, sent by anonymous donors, who were so impressed the kid could be kind and generous that straight away he got a calming reward. He'd only given away one bike, he got three. That's karma. Those are inspiring stories that make me feel happy that there's hope in this world. But yeah, this is like, you know, giving things to save a rabbit or giving things to orphanages. And a lot of times people don't realize the benefit of giving gifts to Buddhist organizations. Because sometimes we think, oh, they can look after themselves. But what good does a BGF do? Or a temple do? And look, I've got a whole drawer, you know, back in my office in Perth, of letters which people have sent to me of just how I've saved their lives. And how the other monks have helped so much and turned people's lives totally around. Even just coming here today, I arrived here about an hour ago.
The gentleman just, is he still here? Has he gone home? Up our scientist books. But he was saying that he listened to my talks on the internet, on YouTube, changed his whole life, and is a much happier, better person. Actually, I have got a letter, I meant to bring it down, from a Christian guy in the Philippines, whose daughter had some psychological problems. He was a poor man, he could not afford a psychiatrist. So he went on the internet for things like depression or anxiety. He got, you know, onto my website, listened to a few of my talks, let his daughter hear those talks, and totally cured his daughter. His daughter is back at school, studying or whatever, and now he's a devout Buddhist. Now that is just the amount of power these teachings can actually give to this world. We may look at the newspaper, we may protest about corruption in elections today. We may worry, you know, about, you know, corruption or people being too greedy. Yeah, but what are we going to do about that? And we can do something about that by having temples or organizations such as this which can inspire people to be moral and virtuous, and teach them actually how to do that. You know, it's great in Australia because people have got this incredible open mind. They haven't got any superstitions or traditions about Buddhism. So, many Australian men and women, they say, yeah, we like these teachings, we love the meditation, but well, why do you do these silly rituals like bowing? And I tell them, look, when I bow, you saw me bow when I came in here. When I bow, my first bow is not to a Buddha statue. You can bow all you like and that Buddha statue doesn't even acknowledge you, doesn't even know you're here. He doesn't see, doesn't record it when you bowed or not bowed, he doesn't care. That's just a bit of plaster, that's all. And even the chief reverend looking at you with his glasses behind, that's only a statue, it's not a real thing.
It's a bit of a joke with the glasses on.
But anyhow, when I first bow, I bow to what the Buddha represents, which to me is first of all virtue, goodness, generosity, all those things which we take to be virtue in our world, because that is so important to me. Now, I've seen people who've lost their virtue, and they go over into prisons, they go to casinos, they get into gambling, they cheat on their wives. You know what happens, and how much pain that causes in the family and in themselves. And virtuous people, generous, honest, trustworthy people, they are just the most, they're like what keeps our society together. They're the ones who give hope for the world. They give beauty amongst the ugliness of corruption and deceit. So whenever I see virtue, I find it so easy to worship. So I bow, I lower my head to virtue. And the second time I bow, because I'm a meditator, I bow to peace. Because to me, peace in all its different connotations, peace in one's heart, in one's mind, being at peace with oneself, being at peace even with one's enemies. You know, I've made a few enemies with doing a bhikkhuni ordination, but I'm totally at peace with them. I don't know about them with me. I've forgiven them before I even did anything. But peace is such a beautiful thing. Peace in our world. So our armies don't need to fight each other. We don't need to have all these incredible bombs and injuries and limbs scattered all over the streets and markets of our world. That's disgusting. And so to see some peace in the world, and that's so important. I can bow to that all day. And that's what, to me, the Buddha represents. Peace in the heart, peace in the community, peace in the world, peace between governments, peace between enemies. I bow to that. And my third bow is to compassion. Kindness, which brings all these things together. Because when I see people being kind to each other, people have hurt you, and you say, I forgive you, never mind, we all make mistakes. That generosity of heart, giving other people the benefit of the doubt, letting go of being critical, that kindness called compassion, I can worship that again all day. So every time I bow to peace, to virtue, peace and compassion. You know what that does to me? It reminds me constantly, many times a day, of their importance. And because I remind myself of the importance of virtue, peace and compassion so many times a day, that's why those qualities grow in me. I don't forget them. I don't neglect them. And every time I bow, I remember virtue, peace and compassion. And that's why I can become a more generous, not just with my time, but with my heart to other people. Now that's a very important thing to remember. It's not just the power of generosity, but actually how it's created inside you. But once you realize that from your own experience, you start practicing generosity more and more. Wow, it's an amazing, wonderful thing to do. And don't think you haven't got enough. It's amazing. The more you give, it seems to be, the more you get. It seems to be a law of nature that way. Even in the car coming up here, Victor told me that when they are making this new temple, they want to put a stupa on the top and need some relics for the stupa. So now, without even asking, because I think I preempted you and say, yeah, I could give you some relics. Because we've got lots of relics in Australia. I don't know what they're doing in Australia, but we keep giving them away and they keep coming back again. And I've seen that many times. It's strange. It is one of those other psychic phenomena. When you give things away like that, you never lose. You get more back. The simile the Buddha gave, he said, suppose that the person next door asks for something to light their fire with. You've already got a flame, like a lantern or a candle. Yeah, help yourself, take the flame. If somebody takes some of your flame, is there less flame on the top of your candle? It's never diminished. That is the power of generosity. Whatever you have never gets less.
weird, but true. One of my friends, who were monks together in Thailand, he was one of these people, brilliant man, but he was dyslexic. He never realized that until much later. So he never did well at school. He went into the building industry, and then he became a monk. And because he had experience building, when Ajahn Chah had his stroke and needed a special place to stay, this monk volunteered to build a place for Ajahn Chah, like a special hut with many rooms so nurses could stay there. He spent a whole year of his monastic life building. He later on this road. He disappeared. Then he surfaced again a few years later when he went to Ajahn Chah's monastery, Wat Pa Khor, to give a very large donation. Because what had happened, he'd won the Australian lottery. And he thought, how come I've won this? And he looked back, what generosity have I done in the past? And it was obvious. He built a hut for a very, very holy monk to look after him in the last 6 years of his life. Well done. That's how it works. But even if you don't get any reward later, but remember, if you give a big donation to the DBS, expecting to win the lottery, it does not work. Otherwise, you'll ask for your money back. Okay, with donation, I don't wrong. You promised I'd win the lottery. I did promise you the lottery. If you want it, it doesn't happen. It has to be without any expectation. Otherwise, it's not real generosity. That's why the best generous gifts are anonymous. You just don't know who put that money in the box or who put that blank check in. I said blank check. I mentioned that in the talk in Perth. If you really are generous, why not put a blank check in the donation box? One person did it. They put a blank check to the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, signed their name, and they asked me to put in the amount. However much you want, I can put. Could you do that? Now that guy is a brilliant, beautiful person. And of course, you know what I did? I kept it for 1 week and I gave it back to him. Because there's no way in the world are you going to abuse someone who trusts you and who is so kind and generous like that. They wrote out something like $1,000 or something, whatever. They did it themselves. But that is real generosity. When you don't expect anything back in return. If you expect things, it's what we call doing business. If you say give a donation to the BDM, hoping your name will appear in the mirror on the top of the building. Victor Lee Hall. That's not generosity. That's just buying advertising rights for your ego. A lot of people do that. And because they do it, they don't get the results, the rewards from generosity. Because if it is, you want your name put on the board, and I've seen that many times in many temples, the names of the donors. That is not Buddhism. It's buying advertising rights, and it's also pressurizing the people whose names were on there. Coercion, fraud. Then we don't want corrupt elections in Malaysia. We don't want corrupt Buddhist societies either. So when it comes from the heart, it's a much more beautiful thing, and that really gives you a lot of reward. A lot of happiness. So that happens in my temple. Sometimes the biggest donation, I'm not quite sure where they came from. You all know that how much I supported women's Buddhism. And now not just with the bhikkhuni ordination. Many years ago, before we even thought of having bhikkhunis, we wanted a place for them to stay. A place for women to be Buddhists. And so I put my hand up, yeah, let's go and find a place. And of course, first of all, you've got to start a fund before you even start looking. So we started a special fund for nuns' monastery, and the money was just trickling in. $5 here, $10 there. You can't buy anything for $20 or $30. A
And then one day, again, one is experienced, I'll never forget. Somebody said they had a friend who wanted to make a donation to my nun's monastery project. Couldn't have a meeting. So he came to our monastery. He was just wearing jeans, I think an old car, nothing special. And then he announced to me that his wife had just given birth to his first child, a daughter. He was a proud father of a new baby girl. And he said, I wanted to do something to celebrate her birth. He said, I'm a Buddhist. I don't know if my daughter would ever want to become a nun or even be a Buddhist. I'm not sure. I'll leave it up to her. But just in case she does want to be a nun, I want to give a donation for your nun's monastery project. That's wonderful. And so he wrote a check out for $250,000. I couldn't believe it. Even me, my hand was shaking. I couldn't believe it. He came from nowhere, and I've never seen him again. Really weird. Was that a person or was it a date? Well, I'm not sure, but the same was real. No, I don't even know his name. And that's the sort of thing which is incredible generosity. People just give that it needs to be done, and you don't know who they are. Now that gives you such a boost of pure virtuous energy. That's why it creates happiness for you for the rest of your life and lives to come. Because look, when you die, in your last minutes of life, what will you remember? Those are the things you remember. You remember all the faults of your life sometimes, but you also remember the beautiful time you stood up and did something which was really good. There's not a donation. Someone hurt you, said, forget about it. I don't want to take this any further. You know, you're my sister. Okay, you know, we might have cheated my mother, I don't care, but no, you're my sister. Let's put it aside. Let's forgive. You know that forgiveness, forgive? It's all part of generosity. It's all part of giving. Those are beautiful acts. And if you can do acts like that, that's what you remember when you die. And that's what will take you into a beautiful rebirth as well. That is the karma we take. An act of kindness and generosity. The sort of things I've already told you now, that's what I will remember in my last moments. The act of just sometimes working really, really hard to serve the Dhamma, to serve Buddhism, whether it's in Australia or in Malaysia or in Singapore or wherever I go in the world, in Hong Kong, wherever. I get so much happiness of wearing myself out teaching. I'm over 60 now, I should be sort of slowing down, retiring. But no, because you also get huge amounts of energy when you're kind, when you give. One of the stories where I learned this, in those first years in Northeast Thailand when I was a monk, when we would ordain as monks, it was our tradition that we had to make our own set of three robes out of white cloth. We'd have to cut it, sew it up using the old treadle sewing machine. We had to learn how to do that. This was a big robe, very complicated to sew, especially the double Sanghati robes. That was really a task to do. And then to dye it, not with some chemical dye. The process of dyeing went like this. You haul water from a well, not even with a rope, with a bamboo stick with a hook on the end. Oh. You'd learn how to take a bucket and hook the water up, just like you may have seen in the old days, those of you old enough. I had to learn to do that. And then when we got all the water up, we'd have to light a fire and boil that water up, you know, just a wood fire, and then we would actually chip a log of jackfruit tree, because that had the right type of color dye in our forest tradition. Jackfruit wood, we chip, and boil it to get the dye out, and once we had enough dye, you put it in the white cloth and you pummel it, you hit it with your fist again and again and again to make it take the dye. You hang it up to dry, you had to be with it while it was drying so it didn't streak, and dye it again and dye it again, 3 or 4 or 5 times. Some of you may have seen that. That is really, really hard work. And you have to keep going. You can't just stop and take a rest. I did that myself. You know, 1 or 2, 3 days' work. And there were 4 monks who were going to ordain, and they were making their roads. One of them is actually still a very senior monk now. I said Kawesaku, lives over in Rajagiri, a Japanese monk. He was a very interesting guy because his name, because he was the same year as me, he's just a little bit younger than me, his Japanese name was Shibahashi. And Ajahn Chah could never pronounce Shibahashi. So he tried to get the nearest to Shibahashi in Thai, and that was Sibah Hasin, which if any of you know Thai means 4 baht 50 cents. So he was always the monk called 4 baht 50 cents. And he's still around, so if any of you go to town and meet him, you know, just remember to say, oh, you're that monk, 4 baht 50 cents. He'll probably laugh his head off because he brings back these wonderful memories of the early days with Ajahn Chah. But he was one of those monks. And they've been working for about almost 2 days, 36, 40 hours already, without any sleep. And so one evening, after the evening chanting and meditation, now I went to the dying chair. I wasn't supposed to do this. I was actually breaking the rules. They were supposed to do it themselves. I said, look guys, you've been up for such a long time. You go and take a rest. I will look after the dying tonight. And you come early in the morning to take over. You won't tell anybody. Please, if ever I say that to you, I'm not going to tell everybody. I tell thousands. So you can please don't believe me. So I took over doing the dying just by myself. Again, I hadn't slept all day. This was the time I was supposed to get some rest. But I was working there all night, you know, just with 4 people doing the work. I was doing it by myself. The morning bell went at 3 a.m., which happens in Thailand. At 3 a.m., the bell went, those monks got up, they came to the dying shed, and to make sure that, you know, no one actually knew, I put on my robes and went to the morning meeting. I didn't have any nap at all. And I had so much energy that morning. Meditation was really clear and energized, and no hindrances at all, no tiredness. Even the chanting, I had really strong energy during the chanting. And when we went on for arms around, I was striding around, I was just like super monk. It was so strange because I hadn't slept for about 24-30 hours, and I couldn't help but asking Ajahn Sumedho, who was a senior, I said, look, this is strange, I haven't slept and I've got so much energy, how come? And when he asked me what I've been doing, he said, of course, you've been kind, you've been generous, that's the result. If you give your time for other people, you don't lose energy, you gain energy. It's instant karmic results. And it's not just, you know, the energy you get from coffee, you know, where your eyeballs pop out of your head. This is that beautiful energy of inspiration, and I use that energy a lot for my meditation. You know, you only have to look at my schedule. Get on the internet, because sometimes people want to know where I am, and the first person who wants to know where I am is me. Where am I supposed to be today? So I don't plan that much. I actually work very hard as a monk. And if you actually see my schedule, even here, in these 2 or 3 days, and it's not that I had a rest before I came here. On the Friday morning, I was working, erecting the roof in Garner Grove of the... And I was working. I was just, you know, up on the roof, screwing things in, holding all the ceiling sheets up. And then in the afternoon, going over to Nolomara to do some administration, and then doing the evening talk, and then getting up early to come. This is continuous. It's like, as soon as I finish here, it's over to Singapore. As soon as Singapore's finished, back for another weekend, waste that weekend in Perth. I work really hard. Do I look worn out?
No.
Do I look like I've got no energy? I've got heaps of energy. Because that's one of the great sources of spiritual power. Giving. Kindness. Service. But there are times when I get exhausted. Remember one time, again, Singapore, they had a couple of concerts they were doing. And I was supposed to be performing in the concert as myself. I can't do anything else. This is me. I can't sing, even though somebody did ask me once, can you sing a song at our performance? And they put so much pressure on me, I said, okay, I will sing a song. One of my favourite songs from my youth. You remember Simon and Garfunkel?
Yes.
Yeah, The Sound of Silence. That's the first hit. So I just sat there. That's the only way I get it. The reason I don't sing is out of compassion, because I can't. Very bad jokes is enough. Singing was really just going over the top and hurting me. But I remember this time, flying in after Friday night talk in Perth. The reason I come on Saturdays when I come to BGM is that talk is 300 or 400 people here at live, those who've been there. Over 30,000 people listen to on the internet as well, live. Stream live, so there's an audience of 30,000. You can't ignore that. So I always try and be there on Friday night. So I came early on Saturday morning, did a matinee performance, and then there was another show in the evening. All the other cast went off to have dinner. But of course, I don't have dinner. And I got so exhausted and tired. So what did I do? I found a quiet place, closed my eyes, to meditate. As you do just ordinary meditation, just like washing your breath, you fall asleep. Because my body was exhausted. So what I do, and this is a great trick for meditation, I remembered all of the generosity which I'd done. Giving my whole body, my life, to teaching the day before in Perth, now just in Singapore, or in Malaysia, wherever I go. That's what I've done. And that soon brought incredible boosts of energy up. Joy, happiness, energy. My body sort of straightened up. And I think some of the people thought I must have taken some drugs. Because from being tired and exhausted, you had a great boost of energy. And you were just empowered. I do that a lot. Even do I look tired tonight? You know, just before I came up here, I was lying on the bed, exhausted. But now, you've got energy. Why? Because of giving. So those of you who want to do some great meditation and really get joy and happiness and bliss and get into these jhanas which I keep talking about, if you really want to find out what the Buddha did, and how he experienced things. You get into these jhanas and you get into a Buddha mind. Not theory anymore, but your own experience. You be generous. You be kind. You give even though it hurts, like I do. And then, you remember that. When you remember that, your back will straighten. The energy will come up into your heart. You've done a really big, good thing. You've actually served the Buddhist society, a group which is serving the world, helping people in big ways. Yeah, you can give a donation to a hospital, but people get sick again. They do. You hear one sickness and they hear another one afterwards. You hear a person's heart. You give wisdom and kindness and understanding inside their mind. And you take a person who doesn't get sick again. You take a person and they don't get sick again. You take a person and they don't get angry or depressed again. You take a person and make them healthy inside. That is what these Buddhist groups do. That is why they really were supported. You can have all the hospitals in the world. Really good hospitals, like in Europe. You know, one of the best medical systems is probably in Norway. And what happens? You get these killers who are now on trial. Crazy people. Hospitals are not enough. They only heal the body. you need places like this which heal people's minds, which take a person who's crazy and who wants to solve a problem through violence. In a place like this, we feel that is not the way. There are much better ways to solve any problems rather than taking a gun and shooting, how many was it, 70 or 80 young people in the prime of their life, taking away so many years from so many people. That's actually what you get in these Buddhist places. That's why I don't at all feel embarrassed of asking you to support as much as you possibly can, even more than you think you can, the Buddhist Gem Fellowship project. Already, look, there's so many people upstairs who would like to come in and sit in front. I've been to this place many times, there's been people outside who want to come in. Not just me, there's other teachers as well. Why do you come? Because what you hear here does actually change your life. Why do you sacrifice a Saturday night? You're busy, you've got many things to do. Why do you come here? Because you know this is really important. It inspires, uplifts, guides and changes you for the better. You become a much more beautiful, happy person. If you didn't have the place, you wouldn't have the monks and nuns come to teach. And I'm getting a bit sort of concerned. There are more people who want to come. There's a lot of facilities. I was telling Victor again on the car last month, I was in Medan. And I caused a traffic jam. 3,500 people came to my talk in Medan, Sumatra. And some people couldn't make it. And they texted the people who had arrived, sorry, we can't come. The police have told us there's a traffic jam for 2 kilometres around the venue. And I was so proud. At last, I've done a really big traffic jam. It's now part of my CV. I like how popular these sort of teachings are. They do have a huge effect. So I'm willing to give my life and give my teaching, keep coming back here as much as I possibly can. We need a place that we can come to. This place is too small. You know that. So, please be kind. And also, somebody once said it very beautifully, if you are going to give with a warm hand, not a cold hand. They explained what that meant. Giving with a cold hand is giving away your money when you're dead. That's when your hands are cold. Giving it to the government, they take their share, and your relations will fight over their inheritance. You don't get no joy giving with a cold hand. You don't know who it goes to. Give with a warm hand. When you're still alive, when you still know where it's going, and you can still see the benefits of where it goes to. And then it gives you great joy and happiness, and that's what you take with you. When you die, you're gone. You don't know what happens to your mind. You leave it behind. It's all gone. You don't think about it. You've wasted the opportunity. Never waste opportunities which you have. So please, be kind. Be generous. And receive the awesome benefits from that. And they are awesome. Power, energy, happiness, never feeling upset or depressed. And realizing you're part of something really beautiful. 28 years I've been working in Perth. Whenever I go back and walk into that monastery, which I've built with my hands, where's my, it's got a car here somewhere, it's on this side over here. A little cut, even from a couple of days ago, working, building. When I see 28 years of hard work, what you produce, wow. Well done. You feel so good about it. You're part of something wonderful and beautiful. Buddhist Gem Fellowship has got a lot to offer. It's non-sectarian. It has not weighed down by the superstitious rituals which other Buddhist organizations and temples are. It's powerful, it's got the energy. Take it to the next level. Be part of it. And you'll be inspired for the rest of your life and lives beyond. Don't miss the opportunity of the awesome power. Okay, there's the talk this evening. So, are there any questions you would like to ask? Especially from upstairs from our higher realms. Please write them on pieces of paper. Standing in common. Yes, you had a question here, first of all.
What do you think of, like, I teach kids English, but sometimes I have to teach English school, but sometimes I think Buddhism or Dharma, whatever you want to call it, something more worthwhile, but something might even work, right?
Yes, okay, you're asking, you teach English, but shouldn't I teach Buddhism as well? Because that's more worthwhile, but you don't make money out of teaching Buddhism. I know that. But when I was a school teacher, I was taught by the lecturers, you always give two lessons. If you're teaching English, yeah, you teach English, but you also teach who you are as well to your students. Buddhism will go along with that English. Examples which you read out. Little stories which you have to explain in English. You maybe say one of my stories or one of my books. Use that as your English lesson. There's always that moral lesson which goes along with even if you're teaching physics. That moral part of the lesson is also where you help those people under your care. You're not just teaching English. You're teaching life. That's what you may think you're only teaching chemistry or through, I don't know, the other subjects, just IT. You're not just teaching IT. You're teaching so much more. And it's who you are and how you teach and how you relate to those kids. That is the real lesson looking at. And teach English, but also teach as a Buddhist with kindness and virtue. Thank you. Any other questions? Anything from upstairs? A question about anything else? Why are you just so quiet? Have you been so impressed? Or interested? Or so confused? Yeah.
I used to be a very big
That's a great question, because in some traditions you put the money in there, in the donation box, and you make a resolution, and may I pass my exams, may the hunky boy sort of ask me out, may my boss give me a promotion or whatever it is. And again, that's not generosity. That's doing a business deal again. And if you do that, it loses a lot of the power. You can do that, you know, and there's some truth to it. Yeah, you're making good karma, so you do get good results. You will be happy if you do donations. But you'll be even more happier if you just do it for the sake of doing it. And it needs to be done. It just comes from the heart, you just can't stop yourself. See someone who needs something and you just can't stop giving it to them. Out of just your habit, just who you are. Because you've got such a big heart. This is actually how it happens. You don't even think about it. You know, when I ever do any giving, when people ask me, if I think about it, I say, oh, I can't do it. That's why, you know, Peter, I haven't really studied the schedule. I told myself I'm only going to look at it in the morning, what I'm going to do that day. If I looked at the schedule you've got, you did explain to me in the car, but I wasn't being mindful, I did not pay attention. If I did, I think I can't do that. So I just do it.
if you think about it, it can't be done. But if you just do it, it's very easy. The old story, I told this just last night in Perth again, from Soaking the Door of Your Heart, about pushing the wheelbarrow. And Ajahn Chah and his deputy, Ajahn Liam, who just came recently to Kuala Lumpur, he made the monks work for 9 days straight pushing wheelbarrows in Perth. For 3 days, he said, I want you to move this urn to a certain place. We moved it there. Then he went away, and Ajahn Liam said, no, that's in the wrong place. We have to move it back again. And then Ajahn Chah came back and said, no, I want it over there. I told you the first time, so I could move it again. Now, that's 3 days' work from 9 o'clock in the morning to about 10 o'clock at night. There's no break. We didn't have any lunch. Our meal was finished about 8:30. By 9:30, we were on the wheelbarrow, working. Maybe we had one break for a Pepsi Cola, that was it. That was just really hard work. And after 7 days of that, I was really fed up. Now, how did that? I didn't become a monk to be exploited as a labourer. This is not some concentration camp in the Second World War. It's abuse. And I was so upset that one of the monks could actually see that I was really upset. He came up to me and gave me this wonderful teaching. Pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the difficult part. That was one of the best teachings I got from all those years I spent with Ajahn Chah. Pushing a wheelbarrow is easy, even for 9 days. Thinking about it is impossible. In life, whatever you have to face in life, thinking about it is a difficult part. Those of you girls who haven't given birth yet, thinking about having a baby, giving birth, oh, I can't do that. There it is, not that hard. Take it from me, I know what I'm talking about. Going to a dentist, giving a talk, whatever you have to do in life. Even like giving a donation to the BDF. Thinking about it, you can't afford it. Doing it is easy. Just do it. Remember that.
There's a few questions from upstairs.
Okay.
Yeah, first one is from Michelle.
From Michelle?
Yeah. She's, what was your mom's reaction when you told her that you wanted to be a monk?
What was my mom's reaction when I told her I wanted to become a monk? My mom's reaction was she was very happy that I wanted to do something like this, become a monk, because she trusted me. I'd been a very good boy. Never getting into trouble, always doing well at school, always being virtuous enough. So because in all those years, I'd always done the right thing, being kind to her, being polite, never speaking back to her, I've won her trust. So she said, I don't understand why you want to do that, but if that's what you want to do, you should do it. The only thing she didn't approve of was that I was going to become a monk in Thailand. She wanted me to become a monk next door. So she could always visit me. You know that, for mothers, that you love your kids so much, you just want to see them. And so that was a difficult thing for me, just going away. Even if I was going to get a job as some CEO in Malaysia, Kuala Lumpur, she'd have felt exactly the same. No. I don't mind if you're a CEO or if you're a monk, but don't do it so far away from home.
Was she a Buddhist?
No, she was not a Buddhist at all. She was just an ordinary person. My story, my father was an atheist. It took me a long time to get it out of him. And the reason was, he said, he was in Liverpool during the Second World War. And he'd seen so much suffering, so much pain. The good people coming back with their legs blown off. This was war. People complain about terrorist acts today. And this one bomb is in the newspapers of the whole world for days. In wars, bombs, thousands of them go off every day. Now, I remember my mother talking about she called it the Blitz in London during the Second World War. Every evening, bombs going off. One went off from the terrorist house next to her. kill the pin, the next door neighbors who were just like here, just one wall between you and the neighbor. They got the bomb. My mother didn't. That's why I'm here. That's how close these things go. And he said, yeah, and that was a very, very difficult time. And my father seen so much suffering, he said he could not believe in the compassion of God anymore. He respected his decision. It wasn't done because of philosophy. It was the harsh experience of life during a wartime. So my mother was just, she followed my father. Good person, but no particular religion. Next question.
Ajahn, you remember so well the good things you did, and I thought one should remember the good things you received and not what you did. Please comment.
Ah, that's amazing. Great question. Why is it that we always think of the good things we receive? Yeah, that's a wonderful source of gratitude. But why not also get the beautiful things one has done? Somehow or other, and I think this is Western culture, we never praise ourselves. And sometimes when we do something good, oh, it's just ordinary, forget about it. You're wasting the opportunity for getting happiness and joy from your own good actions. In Buddhism, you are supposed to do that. There is one of the 40 meditations taught in the Visuddhi Magga, Chaganusati. Now sometimes people say Ajahn Brahm just makes up all these stories himself, but every now and then I quote the students because I know them. In Pali. I am also a scholar as well as a comic. One of the 40 meditation subjects of the Visuddhi Magga, one is called Chaganusati, recollection of your generous acts. That's one of the 40. You are supposed to do that. Remember all the kindness and generosity which you have done in your life, according to the Buddha. So don't just be grateful for what you receive. Yes, do that. But what we're weak on, the thing we don't do enough, is recollecting all of our generous kindness, donations, what we've given. In time, in energy, in resources. It's not just, you know, so giving money. Just giving time, looking after the BDF, cleaning up afterwards, cleaning up after the dinner. All those people who work so hard, apparently you started 3 o'clock this morning having a meeting, but you know, this weekend's activities. That is giving. Well done, remember that. And just cry your eyes out. And you know, I'll do that. Okay, some more. That is, if I don't, I'm indulging now. Some of you were at the opening of the retreat centre, the Jhana Grove Retreat Centre. Now this is our retreat centre in Perth. The BGF, you helped out with that. Had a big fundraising dinner a few years ago. And I worked really hard on that as well. At the opening ceremony, you may not have noticed, we did a procession from our monastery to the retreat centre, which was about a kilometre, carrying this big Buddha statue. There was a way of opening up the retreat centre. And it was the first time, because I was in procession and no one was talking to me. And that's when I started weeping, crying. But joy. We've done something amazing. We got a place where people could meditate comfortably. Not in these dormitories where you're trying to struggle to get to sleep when the person sitting next to you is snoring so loudly. Your own room, your own wash basin and toilet next to your room, comfortable so people can actually enjoy the bliss of meditation. And that was my project for 5 or 6 years. And it was done. We were there. That made me cry. And our tears were coming down my eyes on that procession, if anyone noticed. That's the sort of happiness and joy you get. That's beautiful. That's a form of pity. So yeah, remember what you've done. Don't just remember, indulge in it to the max. Get the big happiness up, because that's the pure happiness which leads to deep meditation. The deep meditation leads to life. Go for it. You've done incredible now. Look, Victor. What have you done for this Buddhist Gem Fellowship over all the years? to be his president, his inspiration, his leader. Never forget that. Think about that until it makes you, your eyes getting water, water getting wet. Get on you. That's the way to go. And then you sit down and wow, you get deep meditation very quickly. That's how it works. So wasn't it? There's a question over there, because when I was back as well. Yeah. After that, very good. So another question from there, and then we go over here. Because unfortunately they're higher realms, so you have to take benefits. High beings.
Right, here we go. Venerable, while we are showing our generosity to the people, it is so sad to know that some people is using this to cheat on us. What should we do about this?
Give more. Let them cheat. I don't care what other people do with my acts of kindness. That's their business. My act of kindness, my generosity is just a gift. So I just give. What you do with this talk, what you do with all the energy, that's your business. My job is complete when I put my key in. So I just get this joy, seeing just how much you're giving. Eventually, you wear people down. You're so kind, you're so generous, after a while they just give in. Because the generosity and goodness is always much more powerful than madness or cruelty. Especially cynicism. Sometimes you give to people. But there was, even about a month ago, two months ago, in our monastery in Oslo, Janebro, donations were disappearing from our box. There was a thief. It stopped after a while. But no, if they want to take, it's fine. There's this beautiful mind of being a Buddhist. And if people give, it's their problem. Later on, I'll have to pay that back. In one way or another. For one reason or another, they feel they need that money. So, they will have it. Don't feel guilty or don't feel angry. Otherwise, you've lost the point of being a Buddhist. So, if I give to someone and they abuse it, doesn't matter. I give them a gift. The joy of giving. Never allow other people to control your happiness or to stop your goodness. Be good in spite of what other people say or do. That's my answer to that.
Next question. My son gets angry often and chooses and curses and swears. How can I cope with this?
Okay. First of all, you haven't given me much. Shouldn't actually repeat the question. Somebody asked that their son curses and swears and gets angry very often. How should I cope with that? It's, first of all, find out why that's happening. I recently read an article from the Melbourne Age, which somebody sent to me, about a number of children who would curse and get angry at their parents and had learning difficulties at school because there's actually literally something wrong with their brain. They were getting so frustrated that they were trying really hard, but they weren't getting the results, which means they were dropping behind their peers. They were feeling that they weren't had any self-worth, they weren't getting on in life, and it was getting worse and worse, and they were trying so hard and getting so frustrated. But it was a Canadian woman, I think Alice Smith something, that was her life story. She's now 61, 62. She was always crying hard, but she could never get it and get the message at school. She could never understand what maths was. Had a perfect memory for facts. But now joining the dots and figuring out what it all meant, she could not do that. And then she came across an article of a Russian soldier who'd been shot, and the bullet had lodged in a certain part of the brain, and his symptoms were an exact match to this woman's symptoms. And she realized there was something in her brain which was not connected. It was not her fault. It was something physical. And so she developed personally a series of exercises to train those weak parts of her brain. Just like you may have had a car accident and your leg's been in plaster for weeks When the plaster comes off, where do you go? You go to the physiotherapist to get those muscles to be strong again. So this is actually what's happening. There are certain muscles in the brain she needed to strengthen. And she did that by developing a series of mental exercises, really focused on getting parts of the brain strong again. And she did that for herself, and then got some PhD from the university, brilliant girl, who then decided to make her life's work and teach other kids. And there was amazing stories of kids just like that kid. Terrible at school, taking out the mother and father out of frustration because they weren't getting on. And all they needed to do was teach new exercises. They could understand, they had more empathy as well for their parents. They could understand what the parents felt. At school, the results started to really take off, and they were well-adjusted kids again. It's not just they're a bad kid. That may be that kid. Check it out to see. In other words, you do need to go to, I don't know if you do have school psychologists or counselors, check it out with the teacher, what's going on, get all the information, and then you may understand why the kid is being upset, what's bothering him. Okay.
Was there a question from somebody?
There's another question from the floor. Ask it again. Okay.
Next one goes like this. You mentioned your father who has lost hope because of seeing so much suffering. How would you help people, someone who is blinded by only suffering, to open his or her heart, which is actually so full of love again? And how to help them to have faith in love and compassion again?
Okay, you say, the case of my father, I'm repeating this because sometimes the tape or the people upstairs can't hear the question. You're saying that in the comment about saying that my father had seen so much suffering in Liverpool during the Second World War, he did not have any belief in a compassionate God. And the question is said that how can you teach a person who's lost all hope, really no suffering, how to hope and be kind again? Now, my father never lost hope. He just he lost hope in the compassion of God, so he actually made the hope himself. He took responsibility and became a very kind and good person. He was a very positive person. He was very kind. He'd seen a lot of suffering. He had a lot of love. An example of that was that, now as any child would, you'd ask about your family. There's a big hole in my family. I knew all the family on my mother's side. But on my father's side, there was a couple of brothers and cousins. He never ever talked about his own father, my paternal grandfather, or my paternal grandmother. He never talked about this. And so it was only when you were older that I really pressed him and said, look, why don't you talk about my grandfather, your dad? And eventually he came out. And please excuse me, but I have to repeat this. This is my father's own words. He said, your grandfather was a bastard. That's what he said. With a lot of bitterness. And that really shocked me. This, probably would shock you, to call your father such a bad word. So why did you do that? And that just opened up this whole memories of abuse at the hands of his father, my grandfather. My paternal grandfather, again in Liverpool, was a plumber during Depression years, which was very, very tough. Again, whenever he had sex with my grandmother, there was another kid. So there was another really contraception. So an ever-growing family he had to feed. And he took out his depression, anxiety, whatever you call it, by going to the pub every evening and coming home drunk. Now some people, when they take alcohol and a drug, just sleep it off. Other people are violent. My grandfather was a violent man when he got drunk. He'd take off his leather belt, and any kid who came close got whipped. Often that was my father. For no reason at all. He hadn't been naughty, just his father was drunk. And worst of all, what my father said really hurt him more than the leather belt was when his father started whipping his mother, beating his wife. He said that was the suffering he'd seen. But instead of losing hope, he told me that once when he was under a particular vicious whipping, he made a resolution. He decided if ever he has kids, he would never ever do such a thing to his own kids. I was one of those kids he had. He could never punish me at all. It was my mother who used the slipper a few times, but he couldn't do it because he remembered what it was like. And so it wasn't that we took advantage of him. I really respected him for that and tried to become a better person. He was someone who had so much suffering, and instead of losing hope, learned from it, understood from it, and decided he's not going to go down that path. He's going to be different. And my goodness, he was. You may have been abused by your parents, maybe by your husband, your wife, whatever, I don't know. You know how it feels? This is such a lonely place. And terrifying. Learn from that. Never ever do that to anybody else. Instead, be a virtuous, kind person. So that's the choice you have. Take it. Okay, okay, that's actually a good timing because it's 10 o'clock and there's many other talks on this few days I'm going to be here. So hopefully I've moved you. These are not just talks that tell you what you can read in the book. This is teaching you from the heart, with some power, with some emotional weight. And that's what Buddhism is. It inspires me to been amongst so many years and still get inspired, still get uplifted, still think even me I can do more. Please you do more as well. Don't take it easy. Take it happy. Put lots of energy and love and kindness and generosity in your life. Take it to the limit and be on. Go for it. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.
Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, it's been a long time since I was here. Three sadhus go like this. You can follow with me.
Sadhu.
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 Very good. Well, that's putting energy into them.
So now by yourself, three sadhus.
Sadhu. 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 Yeah, much better than sadhu. Very good. Okay, any comments?